Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Yes, this is Future Proof on News Talk, our weekly science programme here on the station. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us science@newstalk.com. If you think the Irish coastline is fixed, that the cliffs stay where they are, beaches are permanent, think again, because beneath your feet, sand is on the move, shifted by tides that lift and drop our seas by metres every 12 hours, and by waves so powerful they can hurl multi-ton boulders onto the west coast. Here to talk to me about how we might try to control our coast, or if that's even possible, is Professor Iris Muller. She's a coastal geomorphologist and chair of the Geography Department at Trinity College Dublin. Welcome to the programme, Iris. I have to say, reading up on this, it's fascinating because I just think that all the beaches were always there, and that you know, the sand is always there and the coastline is always there. But of course, that's not true, and probably increasingly less true as climate change advances.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on here. It is true that the coast is probably one of the most dynamic places on Earth. And it's kind of weird that we live at the coast. We love to go to the coast. You know, we spend a huge amount of time at the coast and we just don't appreciate that, you know. And there's this kind of myth out there that you can somehow keep everything as it always has been. But we also know these kind of mythological stories, right? If you go to the east coast of the UK, for example, they claim they can hear the church bells ring out in the sea of the town that once was and now has been swallowed up by coastal erosion. And, you know, so that also is part of our folklore and part of our kind of culture. But when it comes to the now, the here and now, we kind of think we can fix everything in place somehow.
Yeah.
But it's weird.
I have just come back from Micheltown in Cork, and the Micheltown caves, there's a photograph on it that I loved, and the kids were just like, what? And it showed, you know, the part of Ireland, how Ireland was separated geologically over time, where the northern part was down the bottom of the earth near the South Pole, and the southern part was kind of around the equator, which is kind of crazy to me. And so on these long timelines, obviously we see a huge amount of change geologically, but on a coastal timeline, how much more compacted is that? When we look at our coasts today, how likely are they to change dramatically over the next couple of lifetimes?
It depends a bit where you are, of course. So those, you know, living on the west coast of Ireland will know that there's a lot of them, the coast there is hard rock cliffs. So you've got little pockets in between where the softer sediment, the sands and the gravel can kind of accumulate, and it's quite sheltered in there. And so the cliffs take a long time to change because they are hard rock. Now, on the softer parts of the world's coastlines, you know, places like the Gulf of Mexico in the States, and the east coast of Ireland and the east coast of the UK and the Netherlands, in fact, you know, it's soft sands, silt, clays, you know, which we call mud, and that much more easily shifts around. So you can see changes on the coast within decades, years to decades, that are really quite stark. And it surprised me a great deal when I first came over to Dublin. I walked along Dublin Bay and I looked at some aerial photographs, and I could then see this island out in Dublin Bay, which I thought, what the hell is this? You know, and then I thought, oh, there's a causeway to it. It's called North Bull Island. And I started to ask questions about how did that thing even appear here? And I found out that it's no older than 200 years old. So you just think, whoa, this is like a 5 kilometer long island with dunes, two golf courses, you know, lots of salt marshes behind it, which is what I study in my sort of research work. And then I went to the south of the bay, and I got off at Booterstown Dart Station, and I saw this sand spit, we call it. Like it's a curve of sand with dunes on it and salt marsh grass behind it. And I looked at some old maps, and that wasn't there 20 years ago. So we've had this emergence of these dunes and these marshes between 200 and 20 years, you know, or in that kind of time frame. And it's amazing what nature can do. And now we have the Dart Line go behind Booterstown Spit. And we've just had all this flooding in Dublin. And the Dart Line flooded along a lot of its stretch, as many of your listeners will know. And Booterstown Spit caused the waves to break well before they got to the Dart Line. So that it actually prevented some of that overwash onto the Dart Line at that location. And nobody put it there. Nature put it there. You know, so as well as erosion, we have also positive things that nature does at the coast when it changes.
But controlling that is difficult. I mean, you are someone who has measured the power of these waves. You might tell me a little bit about that and why, you know, shouting at the sea is rather pointless.
Yeah, it is a really complicated system, if you like. So if you think about the coast and what happens there, the waves that reach our coast, what generates them? It's the wind, right? So the wind.
Thank you for answering that, because I thought I was going to be put on the spot there. It would have been very awkward.
I put my students on the spot. So the wind generates those waves, right? Where does the wind get its energy from? It gets it from the sun, ultimately. You know, so it's really like a manifestation of how the earth functions. Everything on earth is driven by the sun, and the wind is no different. It's differences in air pressure caused by differences in warming and heating on our oceans and our land. That causes the wind to blow at different strengths, and then that causes the waves. So that in itself is a complex system, because the waves are a function of the wind. The wind is unpredictable, right? You know, how far ahead does Met Aaron predict our weather? Not that far ahead, right? We can maybe have confidence 5 days ahead, sort of, but not beyond that. So you've got a really unpredictable energy source for a start. And then the waves can come from lots of different directions. And the waves, when they break, their whole energy is used up on the seabed. And they then shift sand or gravel around, depending on how strong they are. They can either shift coarser materials or finer materials around the place. But they might come from different directions at different times. So they shift it sometimes that way, the other time that way. And because we can't predict the direction that they're coming from, nor the strength that they have, actually, it's amazing that we even think that we can predict their sort of cumulative effect on the coast over time. So what we kind of look for is kind of sort of average conditions in trying to predict what might happen or forecast what might happen at the coast. But that's not really what then might actually play out. Mm. And in addition to all of that, my own work is kind of looking at plants, you know, and the effect of plants on the coast. If you have plants on a soft cliff, and many of the cliffs on the east coast of Ireland are covered with grass
dunes.
Or shrubs or dunes, exactly, you know, they bind the sediment together as well quite well. But they're also responding to kind of other things. So we're looking now at, you know, increased CO2 effects on the growth of them. And some of them put more of their energy, when we have increased CO2, into their roots. And the roots are really important in binding that sediment together, that sand in the dunes and the mud and the clay and the salt marsh. And so if that's the kind of effect, some plants put more energy into their root systems, which binds the sand together that we don't want to move. Mm. But it's complicated.
It does sound quite complicated, and it makes me think that predicting anything with certainty, which does happen from activist groups to planners, to energy companies, to all sorts of people kind of saying with confidence that they think this will happen and they model this. Are you saying that that sort of modelling is tricky at best and deceitful at worst?
Yes, basically, yeah. You know, there's a sort of, we have,
because
this,
even if you just to add on to that, even if you come up with an intervention, how that intervention then will change over time, is that, you know, that's tricky.
Exactly. And often the interventions that we are used to putting in the place of where we perceive there to be a risk of flooding or erosion or whatever are hard structures. You know, we build a seawall or we build a flood defence somewhere. And those hard structures, actually, what they do is they're not terribly good at getting rid of the wave's energy, which is often what's threatening us.
Because you want something that moves. Is that right?
Exactly.
Right.
You want something that kind of absorbs the energy into something different. Like, you can't destroy energy. Energy is always there. You can change the form of it, but you can't destroy it. So when it reaches the shore, like if you put something there that absorbs the energy, then that's better than putting something there that reflects it. If it reflects
something that will cushion it rather than push it right back because it's made of steel or concrete.
Exactly. Exactly. And funnily enough, nature is pretty good at that. So, you know, we have beaches consisting of sand that arrange themselves in a way that they get rid of the wave's energy before it reaches the high water mark. So, you know, a storm will drag sand off the top of the beach and will drag it out into the shallow water. What that means is that the waves, when they reach the shallow water, they then already start to experience friction with the seabed and they lose some of their energy before they get to the part that we're worried about. So having big, wide beaches, having salt marshes, sand dunes, you know, in the tropics, mangrove areas are really, they were super important during the tsunamis that happened in the Indian Ocean a little while back, you know, now. But
yeah, I've heard some projects where they're looking at, you know, building seagrasses, building, you know, ecosystems, not just for animals, but also for that sort of wave protection. I mean, realistically, though, I mean, reading up on this, you were talking to our producer about rocks. There were multi-ton rocks that were moved by the water. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I mean, like, how do you protect yourself against that?
Yeah, so this is a kind of really interesting debate in the sciences that's been ongoing for a little while, but I think we've kind of resolved it now, is that there are these really big boulders pushed up onto the cliffs on the west coast of Ireland, on the coast of Scotland, and for a long time it was thought that they could have only been put there by a ginormous tsunami wave. And yeah, there were tsunamis, you know, in the past, 200-300 years ago, where, you know, parts of Norway fell into the sea and created a tsunami. But actually, we now know through, and this is where modelling is really helpful, because you can model these things. You can take them into a laboratory and scale them down and model them physically, or you can model them on a computer. And so, and that shows that the wave's energy can actually be strong enough to move big boulders during storm events onto tall cliff faces.
So then what's the point of, like, growing seaweed?
Yeah. So, yeah, very good question. Because actually, you can't just plant seaweed or salt marsh or mangroves anywhere. You know, they are growing in places for a reason. And the reason is that there is generally lower energy environments. They can cope with the occasional really high impact event, big wave events of storms and that sort of thing. But they can't cope with that regularly. So you couldn't plant them on the west coast of Ireland. But you can think about where they maybe once were and have now disappeared. And if you do that, then you quickly think about, hang on a minute, you know, look at our big cities. Where are our big cities? They're in estuaries. They're in places where the river flows into the sea, where it's really shallow, really sheltered. You look at old historic maps of Dublin, and it's salt marshes, sandbanks, dunes, shifting sands, you know. It's disappeared, not because the sea's taken it.
Yeah.
It's disappeared because we've taken it.
Yeah. Although I'm not sure how the people in Grand Canal Dock would feel if you said we want to take the apartments back and we want to put salt marshes there.
Well, we can't now, you know. But now we need to find solutions that allow us to continue to live in these places.
Yeah, and those solutions need to be agile and movable if they're going to be able to work with the awesome power of the sea. Yeah. You're giving a talk on the 3rd of March, hosted by Citizens Group Blue Ireland, entitled Safeguarding Our Seas and Shores, A Conversation. It's in the Royal Marine Hotel in Dunleary. You can pop along to that if you're interested. Professor Iris Muller, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.